in Rosetto Casper with the splendid table. It's red. It tastes so sexy and good, yet it's sin-free eating. It's the tomato. Tomato historian Andrew Smith debunks tomato myths. He has the real story of how the tomato rose to stardom. It's quite a tale about a teaching physician unfettered by facts, newspapers unfettered by fact-checking, and a public ripe for a swindle. Jane and Michael Stern take us to Wyoming for great brisket and old-time rodeo. Hoppin' John Taylor talks southern preserves. Supermarket guru Al Sickerman is setting up a vanilla ice cream tasting. And as always, we take your calls. All this and more coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Welcome to Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's start with a question. Which single food took Italian cooking out of the closet, now this was maybe 100 years ago, and made it the Western world's favorite cuisine? You think it's pasta, right? No way. The answer is the tomato. While I was researching Italian country cooking and agricultural history, I realized that it wasn't until the tomato met up with pasta and pizza that Italian food became everybody's favorite ethnic eating. Tomatoes were pure gold to Italian country people. They were easy to grow. A small field of tomatoes could stock the family for a year, and tomatoes made the plainest, cheapest foods taste better. That's one of the key reasons for their popularity with Italy's peasant cooks. Then there's tomato chemistry. I'm convinced that when tomatoes' meaty, sweet, tart flavors combine with the carbs in bread or pasta, they set off a chemical reaction that makes us feel good. With these benefits, Italian cooks figured out all sorts of ways of preserving tomatoes for winter. One way was tomato paste. Thick puree dried in the sun until it thickens. One Italian writer tells us how his mom always hung bay leaves over the tomato paste as it sat out in the hot courtyard. They kept away the bugs, but more important, she believed that the bay leaves kept away evil spirits. It seems the evil spirits could get into the tomato paste, and then when the family ate the tomato paste, the evil spirits were in the house. Okay, enough tomato lore. Now for some practical tomato information to help you buy, ripen, and use tomatoes. Here's a quick tomato primer. Try to taste before buying. Vine ripened isn't a guarantee of flavor. Look for organic and heirlooms for better and more interesting flavors. Here are some types to check out. Beefsteak, ox heart, sun golds, red currant, Rutgers, and early cascade. Store tomatoes at room temperature. Refrigeration ruins their taste. To ripen green tomatoes, spread them on a shallow basket and cover with paper. This traps in the gases they give off and it helps them to ripen up. Now I've got some news for tomato lovers. The skin and seeds do not make cooked tomatoes bitter. Remember this. There are over 300 elements that combine in a tomato to make it taste. Now, a lot of them are in the gel surrounding the seeds. But I decided to test this idea of bitter sauces coming from skins and seeds, and I discovered that if the tomato tastes great, skins and seeds aren't going to make any difference. Here's what I did. I made two batches of the same sauce in identical saucepans over identical burners with the same good-tasting fresh tomatoes. Some were seeded and peeled, and that was in one saucepan, and in the other saucepan, I just chopped up the tomatoes, cored them, and that was it. Well, the results were that the sauce with the seeded and peeled tomatoes tasted bitter, overcooked, and metallic, while the sauce made of the whole tomatoes was vibrant and really fresh-tasting. So, my conclusion is that you skin a tomato only if the skin is tough, or it tastes too tart, or you don't like its texture. Then you can try this favorite Italian way of making tomato sauce for putting up. I freeze it for winter. film the bottom of a 4-quart saucepan with olive oil. Add about 4 or 5 chopped up cloves of garlic, 12 to 16 leaves of fresh basil, and a small onion that you've chopped up. Stir it for just 1 minute. No longer. You just want it to get aromatic. Then add 3 to 4 pounds of great tasting tomatoes. Simmer everything uncovered about 25 minutes or until it's thick. Let it cool a few moments, and then you can either just serve it up as it is, chunky, you can puree it, or you can pass it through a food mill. And of course, it freezes beautifully. This, by the way, is enough sauce for a pound of macaroni. So remember to taste your tomatoes before you buy them. Don't bother to peel and seed them for cooking. Use bay leaves to keep the evil spirits away, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicle. This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show about food, enjoying it, buying it, cooking it, and about eating out, entertaining, health, and travel. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife of choice of many professional chefs. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, it's our annual tomato show. Statistics show tomatoes are America's all-time favorite food. So we have food historian Andrew Smith with us today. He's written 4 books on tomato history and is aiming for a 5th. Today he's going to debunk tomato myths and explain how the tomato began its rise to stardom. Hoppin' John Taylor, our Southern food guru, talks about the South's great tradition of preserves and leaves us with his killer recipe for pear chutney. Writer Paul Grucco remembers his mother putting up tomatoes on their Midwestern farm. We're tasting vanilla ice cream for the best ones out there with Al Sickerman, our supermarket expert, and the second half of the show is all yours. We open the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So we're going to get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern, who write the 2 for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. Well, what have you been up to?
We have been in Sheridan, Wyoming, and what we want to tell you about, Lynn, is not a restaurant. It's an event, but it's an event where you can eat great food.
You know, all summer long, there are all kinds of fairs and festivals where you can stuff yourself with a million and one kinds of junk food. King Days in Sheridan, Wyoming, has a very, very limited menu. King Days is basically an old-style rodeo, unique to Sheridan, Wyoming, because it combines kind of cowboy bronc busting and English polo playing and steeplechase type events. But let's put that aside and think about Elgin sausage, spelled Elgin, E-L-G-I-N, but it's pronounced Elgin, brought up from Texas by the Friends of people in Wyoming that is cooked every year at Don King Days. This is one of the great sausages you will ever eat anywhere.
Let me just tell you, we keep backing up on you here. Don King, and we're not talking about the fighting promoter with the funny hair, Don King. This is cowboy Don King.
I'm so glad.
Don King is considered the Michelangelo of saddle making. He is probably in his 70s now, and he is still the proprietor, along with the whole King family, of King's Saddles and Ropes on Main Street in Sheridan, Wyoming. This guy is a living legend.
His grandfather, in fact, rode up the Chisholm Trail 8 times with herds of cattle, and the saddle that he rode is now in the King Saddlery among 500 other Old West saddles that you can see. But still, we're getting far afield. I want to talk about this fabulous sausage at Don King Day's Rodeo.
And I want to talk about Bruce King, Don's son, who makes the best beef brisket. It's sits in a dry rub marinade for 12 hours before it's cooked on an open pit. And then it's cooked in an incredibly slow temperature. I think Bruce told us he cooks it at about 250 degrees for 10 hours. Mm. And you see this guy out there with like a, you know, portable outdoor open pit cooker, and he's mopping the brisket with his special sauce and his rub. And I mean, it is such a labor of love. But when you get the brisket on your plate, it is fork tender.
Oh,
and you could just stuff yourself on this incredible beef brisket. Then you can go to Don King's Saddle Shop, buy one of the 20,000 ropes, lariats, that he has on display. Look at all the saddles. Outfit yourself like a cowboy from tip to toe. Buy a horse. Move to Wyoming and start your own festivities.
But now, what makes Elgin sausage so special?
As I said, it's made in the town of Elgin, Texas, which has been known for 100 years as the kind of sausage-making capital of Texas. And since so many of those Texans came up to Wyoming, it's famous there, too. It's got a lot of spice, a lot of garlic, but more important than the flavor, to me anyway, is the texture. When it cooks on one of these open pits, it gets crusty. So that when you bite into it, it's got sort of a crust on the outside. The inside is very juicy, very succulent, kind of coarse-cut beef. It's a beef sausage.
Uh-huh.
When you bite into it, it bursts. I mean, the flavor of that garlic and beef and the smoke that it's been cooked over for many, many hours in the smoker just explodes on your tongue.
And over Labor Day, the rodeo, it's an old-style ranch rodeo, meaning you don't sit in, you know, in seats and watch it. You stand on the ground just, you know, watching it sort of on a big grass playing field.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the bucking broncs are, you know, like 3 feet from your nose as you're eating your beef brisket and sausage. This cool, clear, high altitude air of Sheridan. I mean, it's really one of the most Western events and one of the most little known Western events outside of Wyoming.
This sounds absolutely wonderful. Okay, we know where we're going for Labor Day weekend. Thank you both.
Yeehaw!
My cowboy life is so happy and free. Out west where the laws don't bother me. I take my troubles like a toy. I'm just the yodeling cowboy.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA and Chili Nation. You can hear them every week here on The Splendid Table, and you can get their restaurant finds on our website at splendidtable.org.
She's got baked ribs and candied yams, sugar cured Virginia ham, basin full of those berry jams, and that's what I like about the town. Cornbread and turnip green, ham hocks and butterbeans.
Well, as you can tell, we're taking a turn southward, and there's no one better to talk about Southern food than John Martin Taylor, a.k.a. Hoppin' John Taylor. He's a Southern food historian and cookbook writer based in Charleston. He's one of those people who you call to ask a quick question, and an hour later you're still enthralled and you're still on the phone. Hi, John. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lan.
I always have this image that in the South, when you sit down to Sunday dinner, there are all kinds of condiments on the table, like, you know, chutneys and chow chow and whatever. So why is that?
Well, it's not just Sunday dinner. It's all the time. Last night for dinner, I had civet beans. I don't even know if you know what they are. They're the tiniest little butter beans. They're absolutely wonderful. I had civet beans over rice, cornbread, and I had about four relishes on the table. That's what I had for dinner. And the relishes included green tomato relish, pear relish, at Jar Pickles, and another. I don't remember. It's you know, you have beans and rice throughout the world where rice is grown. You have people eating beans and rice. When the beans are put on top of the rice and there's a condiment beside it, you know you're in the Deep South.
So they're used like a sauce?
They're used as just what a relish says. It's a relish. It makes it sparks up flavors. It adds sweet, it adds sour, it adds crunch, it adds texture, flavor, spice.
Well, now, I'd need for you to define exactly what some of these things are. For instance, I've never heard of ash jar pickles.
Ash jar pickle is spelled various ways, and you probably know it as achar, A-C-H-A-R. But if you look in all the old plantation journals and the old cookbooks from the 19th century in the South, you'll see recipes for ash jar, and it's variously spelled A-T-S or A-T-Z and then J-A-A-R. Well, mm-hmm. The double A is a clue right there to look at places that where the Dutch have been. And you can trace this recipe back from South Carolina into the Caribbean, into West Africa, down into South Africa, where the Dutch were,
mm-hmm.
into Madagascar and in India, and back all the way to Malaysia, where the recipe originated, and where in Java every village has its own version. And you see, this is the spice and slave trade route, which was always the same. And it's interesting, you find this recipe today, South Africa, Holland, South Carolina, Low Country, and in Java.
So what do they taste like? What exactly are they?
It's a mustard pickle. In India, they serve it in restaurants alongside just about everything. Sometimes they'll just put them out on the table alongside curries and rice dishes.
And is this, it's cucumbers in sort of a mustard sauce?
It's cucumbers, cauliflower, green beans, cabbage, and it's in a pickle. Mustard pickle that's always deeply orange colored from the turmeric in it.
What is chow chow?
Chow chow, ground cabbage and other vegetables pickled and thickened with a butter roux.
With a butter roux?
With a butter roux.
And this can be preserved then?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
It's fabulous. I cannot imagine butter beans and rice, or sivi beans and rice, without some chow chow.
What about these chutneys you mentioned, like pear chutney and green tomato stuff? Tell me about those.
I love chutney. You know, a lot of the flavors of the South come from England. And England, of course, had been in India for a long time. And because the South relied so heavily on its ports, these recipes came with the trade directly into the cities. And chutneys are fruit-based, sweet and sour, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Condiments that you always think of chutneys as having big hunks of fruit in them, such as pear or mango or green tomato.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they well accompany the one-pot dishes that are actually sort of the national dishes of the South. When you think about gumbo, jambalaya, perlot, chicken bog, you think of having a chutney alongside.
John, is there a relish made with okra in the South?
Oh, is there? Only it's not okra. Okra's my favorite vegetable. What can I say? We pickle them, but we pickle them whole. You pickle the whole pod, and you have a fairly hot pickle. It always invariably has some garlic in it and some hot pepper in it, and you use them in place, among other things. You use them in place of olives and martinis.
Oh, that old Southern drink.
Yes.
Great Southern tradition, the okra in martinis. John, thank you.
My pleasure.
John Martin Taylor is author of Hoppin' John's Low Country Cooking. You can get his recipe for pear chutney on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, tomato historian Andrew Smith, a vanilla ice cream tasting, and your calls. Get on the line at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com.
Oh, mister, don't touch me tomatoes, please. Don't you touch me tomatoes. Touch me from me apple potatoes. Goodness sake, don't you touch me tomatoes. Oh, mister, don't touch me tomatoes, please. Don't you touch me tomatoes. Touch me from me apple potatoes. Goodness sake, don't you touch me tomatoes. Touch me.
Josephine Baker singing Don't Touch My Tomatoes, a perfect entree to a little tomato obsessing. Now, I get to do this once a year, so bear with me. Close your eyes. Not if you're driving, please. Okay. Think about what it's like to eat a great tomato. You're cupping a big, round, red one in your hand. Look at it. The red's so bright you can practically hear it. Now take it to your mouth. That smooth skin stretched over the flesh. Bite down. Break through and get that first snap of tart from the skin. Now the rush of juice and meat filling your mouth. It's acid and sweet and salty and plush and pushy and wild and mellow and rich. And finally, when people talk tomatoes, this is what the fuss is about. Well, we're joined by tomato historian Andrew Smith, a man I may say is equally obsessed with the love apple. Andrew is writing a tomato quintet, five books, each studying a different aspect of the tomato. Now, let's see, there's been Pure Ketchup, Livingston and the Tomato, and two books in the works, one on soup, the other salsa, and then his first, The Tomato in America, Early History, Culture, and Cookery. So, Andrew, why the tomato for you?
I fell in love with the tomatoes. I mean, I like the taste of them, and more important, I started looking into the history, and I found that most of what went on was called tomato history was, in fact, myths and tomato lore, and no one had bothered to go and check the reality. And as I started doing my research, I was shocked to find that the reality was even more exciting than the myths that were repeated by journalists and those writing articles about tomatoes.
Like what, for instance?
Well, for instance, the Robert Gibbon Johnson eating a tomato on the courthouse steps is told almost in every account of tomato history in 1820. This is the first tomato that's ever been consumed in America, and crowds line up and hope he's going to bite into the tomato and die on the steps themselves. This is what they've come to see, and he eats the tomato, and he lives. And all of a sudden, the tomato industry was started in America. And that's where I really started on that myth, and I went down to Salem, New Jersey, where it was supposedly happened, and after a year of research, I found out my conclusion was that the event had never happened.
You mean so, it was completely false?
It was completely false, yeah. It was all a 20th century myth that the local townspeople had become really excited about the tomato because the tomato industry was important in South Jersey. So they created these myths that built up their history, and they repeated it, and television picked it up, and newspapers picked it up, and magazines picked it up, and authors picked it up, and it's repeated ever since. So for the last 50 years, it's been a staple of anyone talking about tomatoes. And so my interest was to say that's not likely to have been true, but the real truth is even more exciting than the false image of a tomato being eaten on the steps in 1820. So,
okay, so what was the real truth?
Well, in the 1830s, that's when the tomato moved from a marginal fruit or vegetable into the queen of the vegetable market, and it was because of tomato medicine. This started off with a man by the name of John Cook Bennett, who, for make a long story short, created a medical school, and he'd never attended medical school himself, and at his first class he didn't know what to do, so he decided that he would tell his students that the tomato cured every illness known to mankind, and a lot of illnesses not known to mankind. but if you had cholera, no problem, eat a tomato, you'd be solved. If you had a cold, no problem, eat a tomato, etc., etc. So when he was fired from the job because he didn't know what he was doing, he decided that he would send off his first lecture to newspapers, which he did, and within a matter of weeks of its initial publication, it appeared in large numbers of newspapers and magazines and was subsequently published in almost every gardening book published in America for almost a 30 or 40 year period of time. It went from here to Australia, from Australia to the United Kingdom, from the United Kingdom. It reverberates around Central Europe for almost until 1900. So that was the first step. People concluded that if tomatoes were good for you, it would be possible to make a tomato pill with only the high quality elements that the tomato had, that if you popped a pill, that it would solve all of those problems. And hundreds of thousands of people consumed tomato pills in, from 1837 to about 1840. And as scientists began dissecting the pills themselves, they found that the pills had no tomato content whatsoever, which it comes as no surprise. But by this time, people had grown accustomed to the idea that tomatoes were edible and that they were good for you, and many people planted them in their own garden. And by 1840, the tomato, which had been essentially a marginal vegetable 5 years before, became the queen of the vegetable market throughout the United States. So it was a very short period of time that tomatoes became our most important vegetable.
Oh, but now, we don't keep eating a food that we think is good for us unless it tastes good. So
right.
Is it the taste that made this food so popular? Because today, I mean, people dream about a great tomato. They go on and on about how lousy tomatoes now are in the supermarket. No, but it's true. And I'm the first one to lead the pack. So the taste had to have won everyone over.
Well, after the fad of tomato pills and the healthy tomato, which got people to eat them initially, then people decided that that they really did taste good and that they could be used in a whole variety of ways. And I think it was the versatility that did it. Now, the discussion on taste, I will give my opinion, and then you and your listeners could disagree with me. It depends on what you mean by taste. If you mean acidity, it's absolutely true. Tomatoes have wide diversity in acidity levels, so some varieties have low acidity and others have high. And certainly with texture, it matters. Everyone can tell the difference between a cardboard tomato and a really lush beefsteak tomato picked right out of your own garden. So those are certainly factors. But the taste, if you think of taste as smell and you think of taste as that image that you receive from your mouth going through those taste buds, mm-hmm. the tomato essentially has no taste. It's been bred out, so there's not... From my standpoint, the tomato is essentially, with exception of acidity and exception of texture, is a neutral platform that conveys the flavor of anything that you like. So if you like garlic, which I do, you put a garlic on it. If you like salt, you add it to a tomato in it, and it comes through with that taste. So from my standpoint, really a tomato is a vehicle for adding other flavors to it that we like.
Andy, I cannot tell you how much I disagree with you. No, because I'm just thinking about all the dimensions of taste that I get out of tomato, and supposedly there's been some scientific research that has broken down some 300 elements of taste that you can find in a tomato. But I'm fascinated by the work you've done. I mean, this obviously is a very valid point for you. Well, this leads me to, what about heirloom tomatoes? We've all... been enchanted by them because supposedly they have more flavor.
All I can do is tell you that the original tomatoes were hollow. They were not particularly juicy. They were hard, and in my first book I have some descriptions of people actually bouncing tomatoes on the ground. They were divided into segments and they had bulbs coming out in all different directions. And so what you think of a tomato today is what was really created in the 1880s and 1890s. And, of course, it's been perfected since then, and there have been a variety of changes. But it was only at that point that you had a solid tomato that was... That could be easily sliced, that you really didn't have to skin if you didn't want to. Earlier tomatoes, you had to. The skin was that thick. Mm-hmm. And the core would, on the original tomatoes would have been green it would not have ripened by the time that the season ended. So when people start talking about heirloom tomatoes with this holy image, like you just conveyed, I think back to what the tomato was and what the wild tomatoes are like today and say, no, none of us would really want that. Now, there are some great varieties that came out of the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s that are still around today, although they've, of course, changed over the years. It's not possible to retain those characteristics of those tomatoes, although people have done quite a bit to do that. And I do like those tomatoes. I grow them not only for historical purposes, but I enjoy their flavor.
Which ones would they be?
I really love the beefsteak tomato. And the beefsteak tomato came in about 1880. It goes back that far. So what you think of as a modern variety is really not. I love the yellow varieties, the peach tomatoes. I particularly enjoy the translucent ones, the ones you can see through, you see light through anyway. And I personally like the yellow varieties too. So people tend to, you know, think of them as only oddities, and I look at them and say I really appreciate them. There are Turkish capped tomatoes which have on the top of them what looks like a fez.
Really?
There's tomatoes come in all colors. They come in all shapes and sizes. Some are very close to being square that have been recently created, and they're certainly very deep red, which people claim to be purple. There are no black tomatoes yet, but almost every other color you can find. So I like the diversity.
Andy, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Andrew Smith is author of The Tomato in America and his newly published book on popcorn, popped culture. To make the most of your tomato obsession, I've got a recipe for you. It's called the Puglia Streetwalker. Now, this is a spicy, uncooked tomato sauce finished with fresh greens. You can get it two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or go to our website at splendidtable.org.
There's a root cellar, fruit cellar down below. You better watch your head, man. Down you go, pieces on the shelf, potatoes in the bin. If I'm ready, everybody, come on in and taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer, taste a little of the summer. My grandma put it all in jars.
It's the season when even those of us who never cook are tempted to preserve something. The thought of lush tomatoes or peaches simmering in a big pot, filling jars with all that summer color and taste, it's pretty alluring. Writer Paul Grucco tells us of his mother's kitchen on their farm in the Midwest.
When the chunks of tomato in the stockpot had lost their form and the emerging sauce had begun to thicken, I filled the big blue canning kettle with water and set it to boil. It was time to sterilize the jars and lids. The kitchen, as a second pot came to boil, filled with steam. The sounds of tomatoes burbling in their pot, and the kettle of sterilizing water pinging on its burner, and the intimacy of the gathering heat, all reminded me of mornings long ago. Father in the garden, picking produce by the milk pailful. My sisters, my grandparents, and I, at a table in the yard, shelling peas, stringing beans, shucking corn, hulling ground cherries. And mother, in the kitchen, a scarf tied around her brow to catch the sweat, tending the alarming pressure cookers that she used for canning, watching the pressure gauges and the timers closely, lest too much steam build up and the cookers blow their cover, and at the same time deftly retrieving sterile jars from their hot water bath, filling them with produce, screwing down the caps tightly over their lids, and just at the right moment, pulling the cookers off the fire, throwing open their steam cocks, and leaping back out of the way of the plumes of steam that shot up like geysers. There was a faint air of danger and of frenzy those mornings. Something acrobatic and graceful about my mother in the canning kitchen. It was a challenge to which she rose with an awesome poise quite unlike her everyday demeanor. We children were not permitted for a long time to see this side of her. Once when we were still very small, my sister stole into the kitchen while mother was filling jars with boiling apple butter, grabbed her from behind, and shouted, "Boo!" My mother, who had been oblivious to everything but her work, started and spilled the boiling butter onto my giggling sister's bare arms. After that, for many years, we were banned from the canning kitchen. Until I sat thinking about her in my own kitchen that Saturday when I was canning tomatoes, I would have said that my mother was a plain country woman with few ambitions. But I realize now how wrong that perception was. When she was not canning, she baked her wonderful bread, or wove rugs from scraps of discarded clothing, or made crazy work quilts, or brewed wines that, given the abstemious tenor of our household, were not intended for drinking. Scarcely a day of her life passed in which she did not create something intended to be beautiful or delectable as well as practical. One night in midwinter, when I was a child, we were awakened by the sound of a powerful but muffled explosion. It sounded as if the house were falling in. Father got up and made a tour of the premises. Everything seemed in order. He went back to bed. We fell asleep again, and the night passed uneventfully. The next afternoon, I went to the cellar through the exterior trapdoor to fetch a jar of string beans and one of tomatoes for the barley chowder that my mother was making, her best supper dish. When I switched on the light, I saw that the row of shelves along the back wall of the cellar had collapsed. The cellar floor was strewn with the rubble of hundreds of shattered jars. Their contents had seeped into every corner of the room, and the air was ripe with the smell of garlic and onions, dill and vinegar. I ran to the kitchen to tell Mother what had happened. She looked ashen. "Go get your father," she said, her voice strangely soft and deflated. I found him in the barn, milking the goats. He finished with the last of the nannies. We walked across the yard, our boots crunching in the snow. I did not dare to look at him. When we got to the front door, he handed me the pail of steaming milk. "Go on in with this and help your mother," he said gently. I went in, not knowing what I might do to be helpful. Mother sat at the kitchen table with her head in her hands. I sat beside her. Below in the cellar, we could hear the clank and tinkle of glass and the scraping of a shovel. The noise went on for a long time. Then there was silence, and the front door opened. "I need the broom," he said. He was holding a jar of tomatoes and one of string beans in his hands. Mother got the broom and took the jars. She went to the stove and finished her chowder. It was the same excellent chowder she always made. When she brought it to the table, Father said the same prayer he always said, "Bless us and these thy gifts, which thou hast made. In Jesus' name, amen." We ate in silence, the sound of our spoons clicking against the bowls. When the meal was finished, Father looked at Mother and grinned. She seemed about to cry, but what came from her throat was a giggle. Then both of them laughed outright, and when the tears finally did come, it was impossible to tell what part of her was crying.
Paul Grucco's essay, Putting Tomatoes By, was excerpted from his book, Grassroots, The Universe of Home. It's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Where does cappuccino get its name? Think about that. Where does the ubiquitous cappuccino get its name? We're going to be back with that answer in a moment. We have a vanilla ice cream tasting with Al Sickerman and your calls. Get on the line at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls this hour at 800-537-5252, but before getting to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, where does cappuccino get its name? Well, it takes its name from the Capucine order of monks. The friars wear robes the same shade as the drink. Now for the last word on the properly made cappuccino, we've gone to coffee expert Corby Kummer, who says that the thing that gives this drink its mystical perfection is the proportion of two kinds of heated milk, one steamed and one frothed. The classic cappuccino is one-third espresso, one-third steamed milk, and one-third foam milk. Nothing else is going to do. That time, my favorite part of the show, the lines are officially open. Let's talk. The number is 800-537-5252. We will talk about anything you want to talk about. Okay, let's see. Who do we have today? We've got Roberta on the line. Roberta, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Lynn?
I'm doing swell. What's on your mind?
Well, I love listening to your show, but I have to tell you that as a papermaker, I sometimes am much more excited about the things that are going to be left over after making the meal than what's actually cooked.
Could you tell me what you mean by that?
Well, I'm using a lot of artichoke leaves and corn husks in my paper making right now.
Hold it. How do you make paper from corn husks and artichoke leaves? This is great. And can you eat the paper afterward?
You know, I'd probably not. It probably wouldn't hurt you. But it probably wouldn't help you either.
Okay, but how do you do this?
Well, it's actually pretty easy to do. First thing with artichokes is I call everybody I know, have them over to my house, and we eat as many artichokes as we can possibly stuff in us.
Okay.
Then we dry out the leaves, just put them in a bag very loosely, mm-hmm. shake them around every day for a week or so.
Okay.
Let them get nice and dry.
Right.
Then I put them in a big cooking kettle and boil them with some soda ash, which you can get at a pool supply store, or I actually get washing soda from the grocery store.
All right.
And so I put a little bit of that in there, boil it for most of the day,
uh-huh.
8 to 10 hours, and then I drain it and put it in a blender, and you get this wonderful, beautifully colored pulp that can then be used for making paper, which is actually a very simple process.
Now, is it spread on a screen or something?
Actually, what you do is you disperse it in a tub of water,
mm-hmm.
and you use a papermaking screen to scoop it out in very thin layers, turn it over onto a piece of felt, get all the water out, and let it dry.
And that's paper.
Yeah.
Have people been making...
In a nutshell. I mean, you can get a little more complicated than that, but in a nutshell, that's what it is.
What color is it?
Well, it depends on the fibers. The artichokes come out a really beautiful, almost like a celandine green. Really nicely colored, very nicely textured. Depending on the way you press it, it can be very durable. I use it for paper making and book arts, for book arts quite a bit, for covering books, handmade books.
This can justify the $1.49 a piece artichoke that I find in the market.
And actually, there's a wonderful book on the market right now by Helen Hebert called Paper Making with Plants, that I'm sure is available at your local independent bookseller, that gives very detailed instructions on how to use everything from vegetables to agricultural waste.
This is great. Hey, Roberta, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get back to those phones. Let's find out who's calling. It's Maury. Maury, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I'm glad that you take my call. I have a problem. Somebody gave me a suppressant, a jar of cognac hard sauce with pure vanilla beans, and I don't know what to do with it.
Oh,
this is like somebody gave you truffles or you know, a diamond.
And right.
Well, okay, you don't. Normally, hard sauces, and let me tell you what a hard sauce is. It is a sauce that is usually made by whipping together butter and powdered sugar and some kind of alcohol. You know, it might be cognac, it might be Madeira, it might be brandy, and some flavoring, like your vanilla.
Right.
Now, one of the most famous ways that hard sauce is used is with steamed puddings in the winter. Because as you, it's pretty rich. I mean, if it's if you live in an area where it's as hot as where I live.
Well, I'm in New York City.
Oh, boy, you guys are frying.
Yes.
Forget it. Forget it. I'd say save it, stick it in the fridge, and save it for when the weather cools down. But, for instance, you can use it with steamed Christmas pudding, you know, plum pudding from England. But I'll tell you one of the ways you can use it, too. Later in the year, great apple pie. Serve the apple pie hot. And then the idea of the hard sauce is that you have the hard sauce at room temperature, and it just starts to melt when it hits that apple pie. So you know how butter gets creamy when it melts?
Right.
You know, it doesn't really run. It just sort of oozes.
Right.
That's what you do on top of the hot apple pie.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, it's dynamite stuff.
Well, at least I know what to do with it.
Now you know. Now you know.
I appreciate so much your help.
You are welcome.
Thank you very much.
Take
and I
care.
Love your program.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. This time of year, everybody's hitting the farmers markets. And there's something I wanted to mention. It's a technique for cooking peas that a lot of people, whenever I mention it, they sort of say, oh, my God, I never thought of that. You know this business about if you roast or grill almost anything, it tastes better? Well, right now, sugar snap peas are going nuts through much of the United States. They're cheap. They're good. They're coming in from local farmers. There's a lot of organic ones around. And one of the easiest things I know is to take those peas, take a hot griddle, or even a skillet, put it over your barbecue if you don't want to heat up the kitchen. Just toss the peas with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper, and roast them right in the pan. Okay? Just try this. When they start to get golden brown, just a little crusty, pull them out of the pan, eat them at room temperature or hot. They are like candy. They could put the peanut out of business. So try it. Roasted sugar snap peas. Cook them outdoors. Keep the kitchen cool. Heather's on the line. Heather, what's up?
Hi. I have a quick question about sautéing.
Okay.
I'm known for not following recipes and just kind of making stuff up from whatever I have. And I have a tendency to either get it undercooked or else kind of dripping in soy sauce and whatever else I've stuck in there. So I do tend to use a lot of soy sauce.
Okay. This is the thing. When you're sautéing, what you want to do is, because you're putting a little bit of fat in the pan, right?
Uh-huh.
And you're getting that fat hot. Now, if you don't get that fat hot before you add the food, you end up kind of steaming everything in it. All its juices come out, you know, whether it's vegetables or meat.
Uh-huh.
Everything gets very soupy. You don't get deep, rich flavors. So here's the deal. First of all, you should start out with something that's called a sauté pan or a skillet, meaning a wide, shallow pan.
Okay.
Okay? Fill the bottom of it with whatever kind of fat you want to use. You don't have to use a lot. But put that over medium-high heat and warm up the pan for a few minutes.
Okay.
Then add the food. You see?
Wonderful.
Now, one of the things that'll happen is you can decide whether you want to brown the food once it's in the pan. You can just get it sort of lightly seared. And you'll seared is to me not really browned. It's just where everything kind of tightens.
Uh-huh.
And then you, after you've gotten it to where you want it, if you want it to have a deep, rich flavor, you brown it. If you want it to be more delicate, you just sear it. Then add your liquid.
Okay.
Now, let's say you've got some chicken breast that you've marinated in soy sauce and seasonings.
Mm-hmm.
What I suggest you do is, before you add them to the pan, drain off the marinade and pat them dry. Okay?
Okay.
We're not going to ignore the marinade, though. Throw them in the pan. Get them sort of lightly browned on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Do that over medium high. Turn the heat down. Cook them over medium-low for about 6 minutes to a side or until they're firm when you press them. Then what you can do is add the marinade to the pan and boil it about 4 or 5 minutes. Take the chicken breast out of the pan. Then add the marinade to the pan. Now, because the chicken's been in there, the raw chicken, that marinade has got to really cook to be safe. But you can boil the marinade, makes a sauce out of it.
Wonderful.
And then you pour that over the chicken and you're there.
Okay. Well, that is very helpful.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling. And goodbye to all of our callers. Hey, everybody, thanks for calling. Remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. Al Sickerman has joined us in the studio. Al, hi.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am just well. Just to fill all of you in, Al is our grocery guru. Al is the expert on what goes on in the supermarket, and he is the food and humor columnist for the Star Tribune newspaper in Minneapolis. Now, once a month, Al comes in with stuff from the supermarket for me to taste. We've done pasta sauces, we've done all kinds of things, but today I can see what's lined up here. Why have we waited this long, Al?
I don't know. It was so obvious. Here's ice cream.
Ice cream? I mean,
plain vanilla ice cream.
I have paid my dues. I mean, I've tried everything. Now I can finally get a chance to eat vanilla ice cream.
You know, vanilla is the most popular flavor.
I love vanilla, and when a vanilla is a great vanilla, you know, it's my favorite flavor.
Well, here are three vanilla ice creams.
And they're all from the supermarket.
They're all from the supermarket.
Okay, Al, you got to leave the room, okay?
Oh, yeah, just a second.
Yeah,
here,
and I'm going to do this on my own. I'm already stirring, guys. I'm just seeing how this ice cream mounds on my spoon. Now, Al has left the studio so he can fill you guys in on what I'm eating. I don't know. I have no idea. But he'll be telling you in the background somewhere. But now, what's in front of me now is ice cream number one. It has little tiny flecks in it, black flecks, which I hope are the vanilla bean. Has a slightly grainy look to it. Now I'm going to taste it.
Oh. Number one is Edie's Grand Ice Cream, also called Dreyer's Ice Cream, French Vanilla.
Okay, now, this ice cream tastes like old-fashioned custard-based ice cream where you cooked eggs and milk together and then you, with lots of vanilla, and then you added some cream and you put it in the ice cream machine. It's grainy. It has almost a slightly sandy quality to it. But the flavor is really nice. It doesn't taste chemically or anything, but I would wish it had a creamier texture. That's not a bad ice cream. Okay, now ice cream number two. It looks absolutely smooth and creamy. It's a slightly off-white color. It kind of folds itself onto the spoon as I scrape it from the scoop. And now let's taste it.
Number two is Ben & Jerry's World's Best Vanilla.
That's odd. Now, when you taste this, the first thing that happens is you just get cool and creamy. You get no taste whatsoever. Then you get cool, creamy, and sweet, and a sense of vanilla and a custardy taste. And then it's like somebody skips a beat, and you taste chemicals. It really tastes like a little chemical factory has come into play in your mouth. I'm going to do it again. Ice cream number two tastes phony. It's the only way I can describe it. It does not taste like real, honest-to-goodness, luscious vanilla ice cream made by Mom. Ice cream number three. Okay, now number three is very smooth also. Very creamy looking. It mounds on the spoon very nicely. Okay.
Number three is Häagen-Dazs vanilla.
Mm. Too sweet, and there's a phony vanilla taste to it. Great texture. Great creamy texture. This tastes like vanilla ice cream met up with the phony vanilla man, and the man made a great offer to the ice cream company, and that's how you got this ice cream. It just doesn't have that real vanilla taste. Now, I'm going to go back, and I'm going to taste number one more time because that was so far my favorite. Let's see. Okay, I really think I am going to go for number one because it has the truest vanilla taste. It could be creamier, though. That's it. Number one. Al, come on. Please come back in and tell me what I've been tasting here.
Well, Lynn, as usual, the experts have confounded the experts. What we had here was two super premium, as they call them, ice creams,
right.
Ben & Jerry's and Häagen-Dazs, and one perfectly nice, not super premium supermarket ice cream, Edie's Grand Ice Cream, which is also called Dreyer's Ice Cream in another part of the country.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I'm familiar with the name.
Edie's Grand Ice Cream costs about $5 for a half a gallon, which is 4 pints.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ben & Jerry's and Häagen-Dazs cost about $3 a pint. So that would cost $12 for the same amount
that
you get Edie's for $5.
And I think I know what you're going to tell me.
Yeah, you sure do. It's number one is Edie's.
I was always a great Ben & Jerry's fan, but which one is Ben & Jerry's?
Ben & Jerry's is number two. The first one you said tasted funny. Häagen-Dazs was number three, the second one you thought tasted funny.
This is weird. Okay, so much for my palate. I have to tell you something, though. Now, none of these bowled me over completely. So, obviously, I'm a cheap date again.
Yeah.
It happened one more time.
Come on by, Edie.
Yeah, exactly. But it wasn't awfully creamy. I think I'll make homemade ice cream and leave it at that.
Melt it and freeze it again.
Hey, Al, thanks.
Thank you, Lynn.
Al Sickerman is food and humor columnist at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. You can get our vanilla ice cream pick on our website at splendidtable.org. Well, everybody, thanks for listening. Remember, you can call us anytime at 800-537-5252. Do join us next week, and in the meantime, let me leave you with an observation on tomatoes, of course, from the Wall Street Journal food editor Raymond Sokolov. He said, "Real tomatoes are an article of faith, a rallying point for the morally serious, a grail." You by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get a copy of the Stern's Roadside Food Finds, Hop and John Taylor's Recipe for Pear Chutney, my recipe for Puglia Streetwalker Pasta, and the surprising results of our ice cream tasting, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101, or take a look at our website at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.